Hi, everyone. Great talk, Thomas. Thomas S. Pumpkins. So I have a slightly different view on chaos engineering than Thomas does. So I'm not here to sell you anything. I don't work for a SaaS provider. I don't work for a consultancy. I'm just someone that has done chaos engineering in companies before, and I've seen the benefits from it. So keep that in mind as I'm giving you the presentation today. I think, you know, as terms evolve, they become marketing terms over time, and I want to try to remove a lot of the fluff from it and get back into why we actually do chaos engineering. So let's start with what chaos engineering actually is. We define it as the discipline of experimenting on a distributed system in production in order to build confidence in the system's capabilities to withstand turbulent conditions. And that's a mouthful, but the big part of that is, you know, we're building confidence, right? We're building confidence in our mental models and our understandings of how the systems work, and most importantly, how they fail. It helps the user to explore the unknown unknowns of their system in ways that we weren't able to previously. So I work on chaos engineering at Netflix. I'm now on the site reliability team there. But I'm going to tell you a lot about my experiences building chaos tools at Netflix. And also, I've had the opportunity to do chaos engineering at a few other companies as well. So we're going to start with the in theory portion of chaos engineering. Why do we do chaos? Why do we do failure injection? Why unit testing? Why any of these things? So the first half of my talk is going to focus on the theory of chaos engineering, and the second half of my talk is going to focus on how we actually do it in practice at Netflix, at the scale of Netflix. And we're going to get into some technical specifics there too. So my first question is, why do we even do this? What's the point? Is it to simply find vulnerabilities? Not so much. It's not to find vulnerabilities. It's not to reduce outages. You know, it might be easy after you do some chaos engineering to be like, wow, my team found so many vulnerabilities this quarter, you know, like, please reward us based on, you know, this number over 200 that we're handing you right now. It's like, what does that even mean? You know, I could pull up probably any file and code right now and find 200 vulnerabilities, you know? How important are these vulnerabilities? Are they going to turn into outages if they're not looked into? There's a really good paper. It's very short, just two pages. It's called The Error of Counting Errors by Robert L. Wares. And he says in it, error counts are measures of ignorance rather than risk. And you don't know much about safety simply by counting errors or simply by counting the accidents or the number of outages. I see a lot of people mistakenly optimize for that, but it really isn't telling you much. And we're going to get into that here in a second. So it's not to simply find vulnerabilities or reduce outages. The goal is to be more prepared for turbulent conditions when they occur, when they inevitably occur. You're never going to get to zero failures. You're never going to get to zero outages. But you can be more prepared for them. My manager, Dave Hahn, gave a great talk about incident response at Netflix and how we really optimize for being prepared over preventing things. And so one goal is to go on a journey towards resilience. And what do I mean by resilience? So resilience is the ability of a system to adjust so it can sustain normal functioning in the face of changes and disturbances. And when I say system here, I'm not simply talking about the technical part. And to quote Thomas, you are a part of it. You are a part of your system. The attitudes and the cultures and the way you go about things and way you interact with your coworkers, that all gets baked into your system. And that all needs to get tested and looked at routinely. It's not so much to simply auto-remediate a vulnerability after you find one and fix it. You really do need to dig into why something happened and how it could have happened, similarly to what we do with incident investigations. And I really want to drive home, doing chaos engineering is not this silver bullet. It's not this means to an ends for achieving resilience. It's a slice of that pie. There's a lot of things that you can do to achieve resilience, and that's why you shouldn't really attribute chaos engineering to outage reduction. There's a lot of things that go into outage reduction. Maybe it's you created database shards. Maybe you're doing testing more. Maybe you started participating in code reviews. It's very hard to tie a specific thing to a lack of outages one quarter or another. So you might be saying, Nora, you know, I don't really know why we need chaos engineering. I'll just beef up my unit and my integration tests and we'll be good to go. Let's talk about that. So what is a unit test? Unit tests are great, and I'm not knocking them any way. We still have unit and integration and stress tests at Netflix, but we also do chaos experiments. So unit tests are critical for validating expected results on a very, very granular level. Unit tests often mock dependencies and run as consistently and as quickly as possible. The goal of unit testing is to validate what an individual component is doing. In other words, given this input, I expect this output to occur. Now, integration tests have a similar goal. However, they attempt to verify that components work together or services work together and achieve a desired result that way. And chaos experiments, they look similar to integration tests, but in addition to ensuring the system is functionally correct, chaos experiments validate assumptions, and they do it in production. And we can do this by injecting latency or injecting failure in between service calls. In other words, potentially throwing a random exception or just adding sleeps in between calls. It's impossible to know that the system as a whole will be available and fault tolerant to your customers without doing some of these chaos experiments or without doing testing in production. And so let's go back to when we find vulnerabilities. It's okay to find vulnerabilities in teams. I just don't think it's the thing that your team should totally optimize for. You want to find out what happened culturally. How does the team balance competing priorities, whether explicit or not? One of the vulnerabilities you find might be, wow, how could this have possibly happened? How could someone have possibly put this in there? And so that's why it's important to dig into things culturally. Maybe there are competing priorities in place that you as the chaos engineer don't know about. It's important to understand technically, how does the team, how difficult was a change that was made that led to this vulnerability? How difficult was that change? And were shortcuts taken there? Additionally, you want to look into what happened attitude-wise. Changes in behavior from externally driven factors are effective. Maybe a team was being really pushed to open source something, and they took some shortcuts from there, and their attitude towards a particular thing was different than it usually is. So those are things that are all really, really good to explore when you find a vulnerability with chaos engineering. I think it's really easy to just reduce something to a single line of code, submit a pull request for a team, and say, here, I changed your timeout for you. It's better now. But you shouldn't do that. You really need to dig into how something could have happened. I want to talk about some anti-goals as a chaos engineer. You're not there to police things. You're not there to be a rule enforcer. Mark Maron here says, someone says, everyone's going to hate you. And he goes, well, I don't want everyone to hate me. And I don't think anyone on reliability teams or resilience teams or chaos teams wants to be this rule enforcer. That's not a fun job. A job as a chaos engineer is not to make sure people are following best practices. The job is to give context into why the vulnerabilities the chaos tools are finding might be bad and how bad they could be without potentially addressing them. Simply reminding people to be safer or to be more careful before they submit a pull request actually ends up having the opposite effect. It ends up being a little bit manipulative and often quite infantilizing. It assumes that someone is not the expert in a given situation, whereas they're more the expert for their service than you are as the chaos engineer. You're a service owner's partner. You're not there to be a rule enforcer. Another extra anti-goal is to cause extra problems, right? We don't want to describe chaos engineering as breaking things. Chaos engineering is finding things that are already broken. And showing people how big of a problem that they are. Showing them before customers realize it, before they're under the fire of a pager trying to fix it, and they're able to fix it in an easy environment. So again, chaos engineering is not done to break things. It's done to find things that are already broken and reveal them to people. I want to share a Gene Rochlin quote. He says, safety is not defined as the absence of error or the control of a risk. So again, the complete suppression or absence of errors here is not the goal. The goal is to improve our ability to react to these errors or risks as they inevitably come up. So Gene Rochlin is an interesting guy. He's part of a project at Berkeley called the High Reliability Organization Project. And they spend time studying groups that seem to do the impossible tasks, operate highly complex and hazardous technological systems essentially without mistakes. And this is one quote that's come out of his research. So a goal is to improve our ability to react to errors in a way that ensures the customer doesn't have a bad experience, the operator of the system doesn't have a bad experience, and we can learn from said error, right? It's all about learning. If we're just fixing errors silently, we're not actually learning what triggered them in the first place, what brought them there in the first place. So again, it's okay to get excited, and I'm going to use Jonathan Van Ness again. We might think, wow, we saved Netflix from a huge outage here, like by finding this vulnerability, and we should be happy because we found a very interesting failure mode that could only be addressed with chaos engineering. But it's important to note that the story does not stop there. Safety is more than the management or avoidance of a risk or error. Again, especially when we inject latency into experiments, I find a lot of things where timeouts are off. And timeouts are set in just a configuration file that could easily be, you know, fixed in a single pull request. But it is really important to resist just dialing that knob and auto-submitting a pull request there. It's not actually helpful. The goal is to capture learnings from these vulnerabilities. And so one thing that we share with teams when we find a vulnerability is we actually share a write-up with them so that they can understand where we're coming from and learn as much as they can about the vulnerability. So we share what we experimented on, why that experiment was derived, how exactly we could have derived the experiment, what the analysis was of the results of the experiment, and what our recommendations are. And then it's up to them to choose what to do with that. Netflix operates under a very heavy context, not control culture. We give people as much context as we can and give them the autonomy to make the best decision for their team. So when sharing the vulnerability with the team that owns the service, it's really, really important to put yourself in their shoes. There may be a reason they didn't fix the thing you found, or there may be a reason they didn't even know it existed to begin with. Either way, there is a story to dig into there, and there's something to find out there on why either of those or how either of those could have happened. So now that we've talked about chaos and theory a little bit, I want to get into how we do it in practice at Netflix and at Netflix scale. So we focus on three particular things when we're doing chaos engineering at Netflix: safety, observability, and automation. Now, safety is obviously number one, right? We're experimenting in production here with live production traffic on actual customers. We're not trying to cause a bad experience. We're trying to make the overall experience better. And so we need to have very, very careful guards in place to make sure that we can do that appropriately. Another key point is observability and monitoring. We want to know exactly what we're experimenting on and the impact it has. If we don't have good observability in place, maybe we're not ready to do chaos engineering yet. And that's okay. There's steps that need to be taken to get there. Another focus is automation. The Netflix system is huge, you know? It's impossible to create experiments for every little interaction that happens in our system. So we automate some of it, and I'll get into some of that today as well. The tool we use to do chaos engineering at Netflix is called CHAP. CHAP stands for Chaos Automation Platform, and it can catch vulnerabilities. It allows you to inject a failure into your services in production to validate your assumptions about how that service works. So at a high level, it works like this. This is a hypothetical set of microservice dependencies. There's a proxy that sends requests to service A, which fans out to B, C, and D. There's also a persistence layer. Service D talks to Cassandra, while service B talks to a cache. I went ahead and condensed this graph because it's actually going to get pretty busy here in a second. So we want to see if service B is resilient to the failure of the cache. So the user in this case would go to the CHAP interface, select service B as the service that's observing the failure, and the cache is the service that fails. So CHAP will go ahead and clone service B into two additional clusters. Now these clusters are a lot smaller in size than the main cluster. We're not taking all of our production traffic from service B and putting it into these experiment and control clusters. No, we're instead taking something based off of our key business metric. And our key business metric at Netflix is called SPS, or stream starts per second. Now, we base it off of the current SPS at Netflix and take the smallest amount of traffic we can to get a signal for a particular experiment. Sometimes it's 1%, sometimes it's 2%, usually no more than that. So we take that percentage, say here it's 2%, and we split it equally into the control cluster and the experiment cluster. Splitting it equally allows us to have a baseline from the control cluster and allows us to verify what's going on in the experiment cluster against something that's of equal size. So it then instructs our failure injection testing service, or FIT, to tag those requests that match our criteria. It does this by adding information to the header of that request. So FIT does failure injection at the application level, and it takes advantage of the fact that applications deployed inside of the Netflix control plane use a common set of Java libraries. So these libraries all have hooks in them that enable us to inject failure at runtime. So we'll create two sets of tags, one that has instructions to both fail and be routed to the experiment cluster, and one that has instructions to just be routed to the control cluster. Obviously, we're not adding failure to the control cluster so that we can have a proper baseline. So when the RPC client in service A sees the instructions that it needs to route a request, it will send them to the controller, the experiment cluster, appropriately. Now, once failure injection testing in the RPC layer of the experiment cluster sees the request that it's been tagged for a failure, it's going to return the failed response. Now, we don't want to inject failure into something that's not capable of handling it. In this case, we know how to handle the exception appropriately, and maybe we're serving you something else instead. Maybe a suboptimal experience, maybe an impersonal response. So say, for example, on Netflix, we're testing the recommendations list that you see on your screen, you know, Nora's personal recommendations. If that's not able to return properly and that fails, that shouldn't result in a failure of the entire site, right? Maybe I just get shown popular recommendations instead or popular TV shows at that moment. It shouldn't allow me to not stream on the site. And so from the point of view of service A, everything actually looks quite normal. Since all the requests for the cache fail for the experiment cluster, we can actually see what would happen if an entire cluster fails without actually failing everything, right? It's powerful in that regard. And so we know if this particular set of circumstances happen, it would in fact result in an outage if this didn't work as expected. Now, I mentioned observability is extremely important here. So these are things that you can see on every single failure experiment. The red lines represent the experiment cluster, and the blue lines represent the control metrics. And so let's look at the first graph on the left. So this shows the number of calls that were actually successful. And so in the experiment cluster, there were all successes. In the control cluster, there were all successes. In the experiment cluster, there were none, which is expected because we're failing those calls. Now, in the second graph right here, we see our count fallback successes. Now, we're injecting failure, so we're expecting a fallback to take place, which is what we use to handle this failure at Netflix. So you can see the fallbacks are executing successfully for the experiment cluster, which is to be expected. There is none for the control cluster because those requests aren't being failed right now. Now, if we look at the last graph, we see count fallback failure. Now, this is something that we shouldn't be seeing. We expect the fallbacks to be successful. So that means at some point, there is a non-optimal experience being served to a customer, and that we know that we can stop this experiment, not be under the fire of a pager, and debug what's happening in this particular scenario. So again, it's really important to strongly consider your customer impact when approaching your chaos experiments and proceed with caution where appropriate. I'm not advocating for, you know, doing this if you don't have the means to do it. Sometimes it doesn't involve automating. When I worked at a previous startup, we would all sit in a war room and do game day type chaos experiments because we didn't have this automatic stopping action in place. And it was still really valuable for us. So another thing we look at is SPS, which is our stream starts per second, a key business metric at Netflix. And so we monitor the SPS from the control cluster against the experiment cluster. And since they have the same amount of traffic in them, they should look roughly about the same. And we use Kayenta, which is an automated canary analysis system at Netflix that's actually open source right now if you want to check it out, to see if those deviate too far from each other. And if they do, we short the experiment. And the experiment fails, the traffic is routed back to its main cluster, and this is noted within seconds. So a customer won't even notice it, or they will just see a tiny little blip and be routed back to a normal experience. We have a lot of other trap protections in place to verify the safety. So we limit the total amount of percent of traffic impacted in each region. You know, it's one thing to just take a small percentage from the main cluster and start an experiment, but what if I'm running 50 experiments in US East? Then we're taking potentially a large amount of traffic from US East, which we don't want to do. So we limit that there, and we'll just put experiments in the queue if there's too many running at once in one region. We only run during business hours. We don't want to page our coworkers outside of business hours. So we try to do it while everyone's in the office and prepared to handle these things. If a test fails, if an experiment fails, it needs to be reevaluated again before it can run. So someone actually has to go manually look at it and say, yes, I know this experiment failed. We have fixed the thing that it was associated with its failure, just to make sure we're not failing the same thing over and over again for no reason that's causing pain. We also have the ability to apply custom fast properties to clusters, which allows users to test different config settings in their code without having to go through a full deployment cycle. Maybe they're trying to test a new timeout to see if it's appropriate. So CHAP has found a lot of vulnerabilities, and we've had to dig into each of them and develop learnings from them. So I want to share with you some of my favorite ones. So this is from an actual CHAP customer. They verified the service's fallback path works, which was crucial for their availability, and it successfully caught an issue in the fallback path, and the issue was resolved before it resulted in an availability incident. Now, they didn't have a way to test this outside of chaos engineering. They didn't have a way to verify that this fallback path was actually executing when failure occurred. And it wasn't executing properly. It was serving a non-optimal experience. Another really unique one that I appreciate is we ran an experiment to reproduce a signup flow fallback issue that happened with certain deploys and intermittently at night. We were able to reproduce this issue by injecting 500 milliseconds of latency. And by doing the experiment, we were able to find the details in the log file that was uploaded to the big data portal. Now, this helped us build context into why the signup fallback experience was only served during certain pushes. Now, this was only happening at certain times, and they were trying to reproduce why. So they used chaos engineering in that scenario. So how do people go about setting up chaos experiments at Netflix? Well, first they have to look at different injection points that we offer. And we offer quite a bit. There's Cassandra, GeoService, EV Cache, Histrix, RPC Service, RPC Client, S3 or SQS. And so you can do any of these injection points. You can combine injection points. You can do them individually. You can decide if you want to fail them. You can decide if you want to add latency to them. You can decide if you want to do both. And so that's a lot of things to potentially experiment on. And then in addition, you can add ACA configs, automated canary analysis configs that look at the experiment afterwards, compare the baseline to the canary, and see if it actually executed properly and if it passed. And so we provide some canned ACAs at setup. We look at stream starts per second, as we looked at together earlier. We look at CHAP system, memory, CPU, garbage collection, and load average. We look at RPS success and failure metrics. And then we also verify that this is actually injecting failure and you can trust this experiment. But users can also add their own ACA configs, but that involves creating them and knowing what they want to monitor during the experiment. So as you can probably tell, experiment creation can be really time-consuming. We had a lot of long meetings. Typically what would happen is, you know, we would ping a team, maybe before the holidays, and say, all right, let's create some chaos experiments. We would all sit in a room together, and we would spend a couple hours deciding what to experiment on. Actually creating the experiment itself in the UI was a trivial task, but deciding what to experiment on, now everyone has a different interpretation of that. My mental model of what keeps me up at night might be totally different than your mental model of what keeps you up at night. But one of the interesting outputs that resulted from this is that we weren't having those conversations a lot about our different mental models. And so there was a lot of positive output from this, but it definitely wasn't scalable. And here's part of why. So this is the Netflix system in production. And these are all the interactions and traffic that's flowing through, and it's impossible for any one person to keep this all in their head and to come up with these chaos experiments on their own all the time. Or even a set of people to keep in their head as well. And we had this goal with CHAP. We wanted to chaos all the things, and we wanted it to run all the time. Well, only during business hours. So we thought we could do this with CHAP, right? Well, we already have this tool where we can run these chaos experiments. How do we use it to decide what a good experiment to run is? So we decided to get cute. We gave CHAP a monocle. And so Monocle is our insights into services that we use to fuel and prioritize chaos experiments and create them as well. So in order to do this, in order to create these chaos experiments, we thought back to those long meetings we had and the discussions we had in them. We thought back to all the injection points we needed, and we collected a few things that we needed in order to make it an experiment. We collected information on timeouts, for a particular dependency, on the number of retries a particular dependency had, percentage of requests involved over the past couple weeks, requests per second for that dependency, the latency, and Hystrix commands, fallbacks, and timeouts. And when I say Hystrix, Hystrix is our internal tool that's also open source. It provides circuit breakers for us when the system reaches a certain error threshold. The circuit will open and stop sending requests to the downstream services. And so once it recovers, it will close and serve the normal experience. But it also provides things like bulkhead patterns and the fallbacks we were looking at earlier. So for example, when the surface fails, do X instead, a less personal response perhaps. And so we gathered all that info to use to create chaos experiments, but we realized we had to call like 6 different APIs to do so and look at a bunch of different things. And we realized all this information was not in one place. So we said, as a nice side effect, since we have all this info, why don't we just throw it up on a dashboard for people? And so the Monocle Insight service was born. So now a team can actually log into the Chaos tool, type in their application name, type in their cluster name, and see all the dependencies associated with it. They can see things, all the things I mentioned, the timeouts. We show anti-patterns on there too, whether or not the timeouts are actually playing nicely with the retries, which funnily enough was not actually easy to see before. And so a lot of people did not know their timeouts were not playing nicely with their retries. We also show them whether or not they have fallbacks and whether or not something is marked as safe to fail based on a lot of this info. Now, this is useful because you might have a dependency in your head that you say, well, that's tier two, that's non-critical. And you go here and it's actually not safe to fail. And you say, uh-oh, why is this not safe to fail? What do I not know about this? We also allow the user to expand the dependency and see how long calls are taking relative to the timeout. And so in this particular example, the timeout's set at 500, and calls are taking well below 100 milliseconds. So what would actually happen if we added a bunch of latency and pushed that up almost to that timeout? Hasn't been done in a really long time. Is that a little scary? And so chaos experiments allow us to do that and recalibrate our timeouts accordingly. And so they can see this and maybe even fix it prior to running a chaos experiment, ironically enough, and maybe we don't actually have to run an experiment there. And so, from this, from gathering all this info, this introspection, automatic experiment creation, prioritization, and running of these experiments was born. So we took all these injection points, and we automated the creation and running of those. So we can do this with latency, failure, and latency-causing failure, RPC, and Hystrix-based experiments. And experiments run automatically as well. And so in order for them to run automatically, we created a bunch of them, but we also had to come up with a prioritization algorithm. What do we want to run first? How often do we want things to run? Is one thing important to run before another? And so we took the product of three different scores, a criticality score, a safety score, and an experiment weight. And whatever has the highest score gets picked up off the queue first and run accordingly. So the criticality score is actually the product of four values. It's the dependency priority. So RPC clients are priority one, whereas Hystrix commands are priority 100. The maximum percentage of inbound requests that trigger the dependency over the past 7 days. So how critical is this dependency? How in use is it? We want to run those experiments more often. The retry factor for a dependency. And then we also take into account the number of interactions that this dependency has. Maybe it has four Hystrix commands associated with it. Or maybe it's a Hystrix command that wraps a bunch of different RPC clients. So that's really important to know as well when we're determining the criticality. So then, if any of these things make it unsafe, we actually flip the weight and make it negative, and those experiments just never get picked up. So one thing that's interesting that you can do with your Monocle is you can click into any dependency, and you can add automatic impacts to it. You can see information on it, like whether it's safe to fail, its interactions, what we use to determine whether it was safe to fail. You can also see the test cases that are associated with it. So you can see a needs attention tag next to one. That just means that it failed and it wasn't supposed to fail, and someone needs to look at it to tell us whether or not it's safe. And then you can also see the generated runs and their outcome of them. What region we ran it in, what we derived. And so we found a lot of vulnerabilities with Monocle. We found misconfigured timeouts. We found retries that were happening on the same server. We found unwrapped RPC calls. And we found Hystrix commands with no fallbacks for non-critical services. And again, like, service owners weren't being careless here. But there was a lot of this information wasn't in one place, and they didn't have a good way of knowing about it. And ironically enough, this ended up leading to less chaos experiments that needed to be run just by having some of this info. So this also led to some new safety mechanisms. We can explicitly add a curated impact to a dependency. So maybe we think it's safe to fail, but the user says, oh no, this actually has an impact to SPS, or this has an impact to sign up, or this has an impact to downloads. And so they can add that, and the runner will not pick it up. The runner will not pick it up off the queue. So they can do that by clicking on their dependency and stating which one. It records the user who adds it. It records if anyone deletes it at some point. And we're hoping to get to a point where an experiment can run and add an impact automatically if there is one. So in summary with CHAP's monocle, it gives us crucial optics in one place. It automatically generates experiments for us. It automatically prioritizes them. And it finds vulnerabilities before they become outages. Additionally, it reduces the cognitive burden on teams that was created before by exploring these unknown unknowns and seeing these mental models in action. So I think the most important benefit of chaos tools is not, again, finding vulnerabilities. It's improving things. It's improving how we communicate each other. It's improving the culture of our company. And so here are some ways it's improved the culture at Netflix. We've gone from a culture shift of what happens if this fails to what happens when this fails. We've become a lot more comfortable with failure. And we want to be more comfortable with how we react to it and how we mitigate it. We have higher confidence in the ability to deal with disasters as they happen. Oh, we've seen this before. We know how to reduce the blast radius here. And we have greater trust in injecting purposeful failure techniques. Over time, the more you do this, the more second nature it's going to become. And you're going to have teams coming up to you asking you for advice on how you can chaos test a particular service. There's also been a change in mental models. Oh, wow, I thought that failure didn't actually do anything. It was supposed to return an empty list, and that was it. You figure out, oh, it actually impacted this service over here. And you shift your mental model. You shift how you view the system. And most importantly, you have conversations about what mental models you had to begin with. So if I can leave you with some key takeaways from this talk, it's that pervasive cultural patterns play out in implementing and advocating for chaos engineering. Don't ignore them, because they're part of the main benefit here. Safety monitoring and thorough investigations are key when trying to surface system vulnerabilities. And chaos engineering is not about breaking things. It's about finding things that are already broken and surfacing them to people. And one final thing, when you're running your chaos experiments, it's really important not to lose sight of your company's coworkers, or your company's customers, or your coworkers. We want them to have a great experience as well. Thank you.